The following program has some naughty language, so if you are listening to this near little ears, make sure they have little earbuds, but you may also want to distract them. I suggest shadow puppets. It's Monday, July 18th, 2022, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Fist bumps and monkeypox. Two big items in the news, one international, one domestic. I'm fairly sure that at least one is meaningless, and I'm inclined to say it's the fist bumping. Fist bumping of world leaders getting so much attention, probably not as important as the new viral craze that's been sweeping the nation. But how alarmed should we be over monkeypox? Vaccine stockpiles are low, reaction was less than swift, but to what effect? This is where I turn to media to mediate the gap between me, the citizen, and them, the experts, the New York Times. Headline, vaccine supply for monkeypox is falling short. The machine is just so ossified, said Greg Gonsalves, an activist and epidemiologist at the Yale School of Public Health. The house is on fire, and it's like everything is moving at sort of normal speed. Well, that sounds alarming, and maybe it is. Except I know a little too much about activist and epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves. Gonsalves is a highly credentialed scientist and a winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant. He's also a bit of a bomb thrower, as I see it. I'm sure he would say these bombs were necessary and are necessary, especially going back to when he lived through the AIDS epidemic. And he'd say they're necessary now. But 3 days ago, White House coronavirus response coordinators, also looking at the monkeypox issue, Ashish Jay, issued this fairly anodyne quote about the administration's posture, quote, "We have tests, we have vaccines, we have therapies. We're building up our capacity on all of them, and they're going to become more and more readily available to the American people." This doesn't tell me, don't worry. This doesn't say we are all over it. It says the virus is spreading, and we're trying to combat it, and we'll have more tests and therapy. Of course you will. What are you going to have, less? Gonsalves tweeted of the claim of more tests and therapies, quote, "absolute bullshit, an insult, a lie." A lie? That we'll have more vaccines is a lie? Yes, they're slow getting out of Denmark. There are no more coming? He didn't back up that tweet with spelling out why it's a lie. He just said, you know, he didn't like the cheerleading tone. Fine, that doesn't make it a lie. Gonsalves is among the most outspoken critics of the current approach to COVID. He thinks it's dangerously blasé. We should be, he advises, still be masking, and the government should not have dropped the mandates. Others in the field disagree, among them Lena Wen, the Washington Post and CNN infectious disease expert. Here she is talking to Stat News's The Read Out Loud podcast.
How much do I want to keep on avoiding COVID? And I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to be cavalier and say that COVID isn't real or that long COVID isn't real or that there aren't consequences to getting COVID. What I'm saying is, if it looks like all of us are going to contract COVID in the near future, if we have not already, what are you willing to give up in order to keep on avoiding it? Are you willing to take on this risk, knowing that if you attend any indoor gatherings without masks, there will be a risk of contracting COVID?
And here's how Gonsalves characterized that sentiment.
And Dr. Wen and sort of what I call COVID nihilists are saying, you know, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter if you get COVID. Everybody's going to get it anyway. And that's what she said in her broadcast with you last week.
He added when speaking in that same interview on WNYC Radio a few months ago.
Dr. Wen is basically tilting at straw men and suggesting that anybody who suggests we should really keep investing in pandemic mitigation is somehow living in a fantasy land.
That's an uncharitable and I'm going to say inaccurate way to describe Wen's point of view as I hear it. Just like saying Ja is a liar is an extreme description, Gonsalves comes by his conclusions honestly. I don't think he's lying when he says that this is how he hears Wen and Ja. They're of course grounded in science. I don't doubt that. But maybe it's just that the epidemiologist part of activist and epidemiologist overwhelms the other. I see his descriptions as hyperbolic. So when he's the source claiming the house is on fire when it comes to monkeypox, I can't quite rush for the exits. And it's true in fields other than COVID, like constitutional law. Take Lawrence Tribe. When he's quoted in a piece I'm reading, I say, now, is this Harvard's Lawrence Tribe or is this Twitter's Lawrence Tribe? Because one guy is one of the top constitutional lawyers in America, and the other guy's a nut job. I don't like Mitch McConnell either, but I would never, from my lofty perch as podcast host, tweet anything as personally sneering as Tribe did in commenting on a Mitch McConnell pronouncement about judges. Tribe's tweet, "Hypocrisy is McTurtle's middle name and his first and last name too. What a flagrant dickhead." Not pulling out one tweet or one statement. Tribe does this all the time. He chases the dopamine hits and the 8 more Twitter followers, and you got the dunk, you're rewarded. But hundreds of statements like this, one after the other, as a news consumer, make me massively discount Tribe's insight. I can find a lot of insightful constitutional scholars who comport themselves with a lot more dignity. And if I want even a fiery podcast host, I could listen to Leah Littman, Kate Shaw, and Melissa Murray, who could bring it without having to fling it. And by fling it, I mean the, the caca. All of this is contributing to my, and I think also a lot of other people's, epistemic uncertainty. 10 years ago, an article quoting top epidemiologists might not be gospel, but you could take it on faith. Now, I have to go through the mental process of weighing what's quoted against what I know of the quoted parties as the outrage algorithm complex grinds on. On the show today, it's a full show interview with Liz Smith, whose new book, Any Given Tuesday, A Political Love Story, drops tomorrow. Liz Smith is in the mold of brazen, insightful, profane, and profound political consultants. Her clients include Pete Buttigieg, Claire McCaskill, and Bill de Blasio, also in an advisory capacity, Andrew Cuomo, a relationship which takes up some of the book and a lot of this conversation, which I compliment Liz for. She's not ducking the questions. Smith is generally of the mind that fringes of the Democratic Party often act against the party's self-interest, though she's also intimately familiar with politicians gleefully immolating their own careers without anyone else to blame. Liz Smith for the full show up next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, "Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender." And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Liz Smith is a political consultant of the Devil May Care pirate ship variety. She also has deeply held convictions. She has won with Claire McCaskill. She headed Obama's 2012 rapid response team. She became best known as the senior communications director for Pete Buttigieg. And she has had different relationships with the New York triumvirate of Elliot Spitzer, Bill de Blasio, and Andrew Cuomo, the three most powerful men in New York politics of this millennium. Maybe you want to put Bloomberg in there. So of those three, she dated one, got essentially fired by another, and offered advice and now intense condemnation of the third. That would be Cuomo. It's all in the book, Any Given Tuesday, A Political Love Story. Liz, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you. Wow, you made it. My story sounds so dramatic.
What? It's not? I mean, it's not?
Well, it is. It is. But hopefully people can take away more than just the drama from it.
Right. So at this point in the life of someone who does what you do would not normally be the point that the memoir comes out, the time for reflection. But as I see it, and as I see it through your eyes, were you thinking that you needed to maybe set the record straight or address specifically your involvement with Andrew Cuomo? Because you do advise Cuomo. Tell me how you got sucked into that in the beginning.
So I had consulted for Governor Cuomo on his 2018 campaign on both the primary and the general.
Not exactly a heavy lift, right?
Right. Right. And I talk about that in the book. But, you know, he wanted to make sure that he's a guy who likes to win by big margins. And so he called me, went to work for him. And, you know, as a consultant, you're not involved really in the day to day, right? Like, I'm not in the office with him. I was never in Albany except for a couple debate prep sessions, but my interactions with him were, you know, largely positive. And I kept in touch with him during Pete's presidential campaign. He would call me to offer me encouragement. I remember once he told me, you've got to take notes, you've got to write a book. And so I had a really positive relationship with him.
Right. So let's pause. And I just want to go back about your recollections of your impressions of Cuomo. Politics is a tough business. Many politicians are really bare knuckled. And even the ones, in my experience, that have the fuzziest reputations absolutely understand where all the votes are, how to get them, what's needed to be done. And they're, you know, not naive about the hard tactics involved. That said, did you think, you know, in 2018 or before, of Andrew Cuomo as one or two deviations away from the standard politician in terms of how bare knuckles and how down in the mud he would get?
You know, that's a good question. I guess I would say yes, but that in New York politics, it was almost viewed as a necessity to be that way, to wrangle the state government and to be able to, you know, deal with the mayor of New York City. You know, New York is a very, very big state. It is very difficult to govern. You have a very rowdy state legislature. The governor and the mayor have traditionally had, you know, been at loggerheads no matter, you know, what year it is. So New York has a long history of having both mayors and governors who are probably one or two standard deviations away from, you know, your normal politician, right?
It selects
it's not like
for
being
that.
Governor
yeah.
of it's not like being governor of Ohio or Iowa. It's a whole different deal.
Right. I mean, John Kasich is now popping into my head saying, how dare you? But you're right. The New York press corps, the three men in a room situation in the legislature, people outside New York don't understand the long history of dysfunction. Just the setup between the extremely important issue of the subway, which can never be solved because no one has ownership of it. You're absolutely right. And I want to get back to that in a second. But let's talk for a second about the stupid Cuomo sexual thing, which used to mean that people were so enamored by his handling of the pandemic that they were sexually attracted to him. In the book, you write about how ridiculous it was. But if I got you at the time and I were to say, give you some sodium pentothal and give me the assessment of how he's really doing in handling COVID and handling the communication around it, what would you have said?
There's a reason why he became, you know, a national phenomenon, a global phenomenon. You know, he was given Emmys. People call themselves Cuomosexuals, which is absurd. But he was a perfect antidote to Donald Trump in that moment. And he was giving people everything that they needed in that moment. He was giving them facts, you know, how many hospitalizations there had been that day, how many deaths there had been that day. But he mixed the facts with empathy, with emotion. He told stories about his own family. He read letters he received from constituents. And he sort of, you know, it was sort of like a modern day fireside chat. Mm-hmm. At some point, though, I think it started to turn, you know, mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy to pinpoint because it was when he started to get criticism over his policy on returning COVID patients to nursing homes. And what he should have said then was that, you know, he was following guidance from the CDC and this is a once in a lifetime pandemic. You're not going to get everything right. And that maybe New York didn't get that quite right. But instead of doing that and sort of striking a tone of contrition, he got really defiant. And that's when I say that, you know, America's governor was turning into America's asshole, because it's like he could not deal with the idea that he wasn't this perfect COVID hero, superhero, that he maybe had made mistakes and that he maybe had to say, hey, I'm sorry, I fucked this up. And if he had done that, I think that would have, you know, helped with a lot of his problems down the line.
Yeah. So he is first hit with allegations. The first accuser is Lindsay Boylan. Her major allegations are that he asked her to play strip poker and kissed her. Other allegations start emerging. There is a former staffer named Charlotte Bennett, where she revealed to him that she was a sexual assault survivor. He plowed ahead and asked her about, you know, would she be bothered by age differences between her and the person she dated. The accrual of these accusers, and they were of a different variety, had an effect on you. But was there a breaking point? Was there a point when you said, okay, it's one accuser, okay, it's two accuser, and now at this point, I no longer believe him?
I talk about in the book, there was an allegation, about him, you know, groping a staffer at the executive mansion. And that's when a lot of us were like, you know, what the hell? And, you know, this isn't what we signed up for. This is disgusting. But again, you know, he got on the phone with us and vehemently denied it. And you could say, okay, well, why didn't you cut the cord just then? But it really was when the AG report came out and all of it was laid out. And he had told us that nothing new would be in there. He had looked us all in the eye and said nothing new would be in there. And then there was this allegation that he had been inappropriate with the state trooper. And for people who don't, you know, aren't enmeshed in politics, governors are tasked with, you know, detail, with police details. They have police details for their protection, usually the state troopers. And it was just vile to me that, you know, he would act inappropriately, that inappropriately with someone who was tasked with protecting him. But that he had lied to us again. And that's when we all just said, you got to go. It's time for you to resign. There was not a single advisor around him at that point that didn't think he needed to resign. And, you know, 10 days later, he did.
Well, you say, and I don't think it was at this point, but you tell me, that when all the advisors were of one mind, Bill Clinton gave him different advice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it then?
Yes. Yeah. So it was the day the AG report came out. He got on a call with us, and you know, another advisor told him it's over, and he asked me what I thought, and everyone was in agreement that it was over and that he had to resign. And then the next day, you know, as he was still making calls around to find someone who would dissent with us, someone who would say, hey, you don't have to actually resign. He did find one person, mm-hmm. and that person was former President Bill Clinton, who told him, you got to go out there, you got to make your case directly to the people of New York and say that your fate is in their hands and not the politicians.
So here we have an executive. He has a team of longtime, very skilled advisors. They're all giving him the same advice. He seeks out advice that tells him what he wants to hear. Does this make Bill Clinton team crazy in this analogy?
You know, I think we're all in this. I feel like we're all team crazy in this,
well, I mean,
in this analogy,
seriously, like,
but yes.
Why do you think Clinton said that? I can think of a number of things. He was living in the 90s. He did it. Some sort of psychological self-justification. Maybe he also has great political skills. I don't know. Maybe there's a chance he was right.
I think he was probably projecting some of his own situation onto Andrews. And it's not dissimilar from why I decided to sort of get involved and help Andrew through this, because I had been a crisis. I had been in a crisis. I had been a target of a lot of attacks in the media. And, you know, Bill Clinton.
And this was when you were dating Elliot Spitzer,
yeah,
and were on the front page of the Post and
right,
were accused of being the recipient of some toe sucking.
Right, which is false, extremely false. And I, But I knew the isolation that came with, you know, being in the spotlight that way, the people who leave you, the people who you thought were your friends or colleagues, you know, suddenly just, you know, drop you like a hot potato. And I think Bill Clinton knew that too. Yeah. And was trying to be a sympathetic voice. And, you know, he probably honestly did believe that there was a chance that Andrew could get through it, but there really wasn't.
Yeah. You, in the book, there's a lot of detail about what Chris Cuomo's dynamic was during all this. He could be a dick telling you guys, I know the media, you don't know the media. But he also was, as you describe it, sort of a temperate force to his brother's worst instincts. And you even get into a little bit about how after Mario's death, Andrew sort of retreated into a bit of a bubble or got even more hardened. Knowing what you know about what his involvement was, do you think that CNN, if it wanted to maintain faith with its audience, needed to punish him in some way?
Yeah, I don't think it was unreasonable for them to do that. I don't. Because when because even though he's an opinion anchor, essentially, but he was giving advice to his brother, who was a politician. And I don't think CNN was in the wrong for, you know, for punishing him for that.
Mm-hmm. And when it was going on, when he was involved in meetings that you were in, were you thinking this to some extent? Like, was one of your eyebrows raised a little bit? I can't believe he's going on TV as an anchorman and at the same time being essentially a political consultant, even if it is his brother he loves.
Well, no, because he was recused from, well, two things. One, he was recused from covering it. But two, you know, and I write about this in the book, and I think it is a really important thing for people to understand, is there is a fog of war that comes when you are in the middle of a shitstorm like this, when you're in the middle of a crisis of this magnitude, where all of the local and national press is bearing down on you, when, you know, every other day, someone new is coming out of the woodwork and saying he's got to resign. When new allegations are popping up seemingly out of nowhere after you've been told nothing more can come forward, that you don't have the luxury to step back and say, you know, why am I doing this? Why should I be doing this? Why is Chris doing this? Why are any of us doing this? Is this worth our time? And that's a question I really wish, those are questions that I really wish I had asked myself, and that I'm sure others involved would have loved to have asked themselves.
But you did ask yourself. I mean, you were aware and you took steps during that whole time to insulate yourself from some of the most tangible entanglements. Like, you didn't take money for your consulting, and that was a calculation, right, on your part, that you didn't want to be seen as having taken money for your consulting.
Well, part of it is, you know, I'm human.
Yes.
And I'm someone who had been tarred and feathered in the press in the past, you know, because of my relationship with the New York governor. And I wanted to help Andrew, but I also didn't want to get, you know, frankly, some of the same grief that I had had, that other people have never had to deal with. And I still deal with, you know, some of the trauma that being in the public spotlight caused me. And so a lot of it was about, you know, protecting not just my reputation, but protecting me, my mental health, yeah, because I just didn't want to go through that again.
During that time, it seemed that you were more aware than the actual supposedly trusted member of the media of how the media actually worked.
Well, I think you need to take into consideration the fact that the fog of war was times 1,000 for him, because this was his brother. This
right.
was someone who had, you know, who had been like a father figure for him growing up. You know, he was, I think, 13 years older, and with the Cuomos, family comes first. And maybe that consumed Chris and that undermined some of his media savvy in the moment. But I think for him, it was family first, media savvy second.
Yeah, in my adult life, I've changed my opinion on loyalty. I used to just think of it as a virtue. But when you go back to the Latin root words, fidelis and so forth, it certainly is. But then I remember the George W. Bush administration used to always talk about that loyalty was what he prized the most. And I got to thinking about it, why would someone prize loyalty in a subordinate unless they knew that loyalty was going to be tested? If one were confident, if a leader is confident in his or her ability to earn loyalty, they wouldn't talk so much about the necessity for loyalty, would they? I don't know if you've contemplated the whole idea of loyalty. It seems like you have a little.
Well, yeah. I think that's a good point. There's also a dynamic on campaigns and in government administrations, like a family dynamic, that it can be great, but it can also be unhealthy. And so there's a difference between earned loyalty and blind loyalty. And in my case, I sort of conflated loyalty with integrity. Mm-hmm. And I put my integrity, my reputation on the line for someone who didn't deserve it. It's something that everyone needs to figure out where to draw that line, and that it needs to be earned loyalty and not blind loyalty. And that loyalty, as you said, isn't always a virtue.
Do you think the AG's report by Tish James, who, by the way, you worked for as an advisor before to help her gain that position, yeah, as AG, do you think it was well done and fair?
Look, there have been some autopsies done about it that it had left out some key facts, that it was clearly written with a predetermined conclusion. And I think that, look, I think that there is some truth to it, but it doesn't take away from the ultimate fact that there was clearly a pattern of Andrew Cuomo acting inappropriately with people.
Mm-hmm. I watched your entire testimony in preparation of this interview, and there were a couple times I thought it was fascinating. First of all, that was the first time you'd ever been deposed or had to raise your hand in a proceeding like that?
Yeah, well, first and hopefully last, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I got the impression that they were asking you at times unfair questions, like...
But in your understanding, is sexual harassment necessarily sexual in nature, yes or no? And to be clear, it can be yes, no, or I don't know.
How is a person supposed to answer that? It seems like they're trying to trick you into agreeing to a tautological definition that they could yank the rug out and say, haha, no, it's not. It's not always sexual. It's based on gender. But then, of course, sexual sometimes means gender. So what do you think of that question or any other questions that you might have been frustrated with?
Yeah, I mean, I have the same questions you do about them. And I found some of the questions to be incomprehensible.
I don't know, and I don't necessarily understand the question.
It was a 10-hour deposition, so I haven't gone back and watched it, so your recollection of it is probably better than mine.
Uh-huh, that's good. You do not recall. No, I know you don't. When you were pitching it, this is in the book, but when Pete Buttigieg interviewed you, you were really interviewing him. What were you looking for in those calls with Buttigieg that convinced you that this could be an interesting guy to work with?
I talked with him in December of 2016. It was in that just crazy, depressing, dark, confusing time after, Donald Trump shocked a lot of people, including myself, by winning the presidency and made Democrats sort of do a lot of soul searching. And I know a lot of people, you know, political operatives like me who left the business after that because they were like, you know, fuck this. I don't want to be a part of this business if, you know, this is a world where we can see someone like Donald Trump get elected. And that the only way to beat Trump was to be Trump. And, you know, Eric Holder was going around saying stuff like, you know, when they go low, we kick them in the head. And, you know, I just remember looking at cable news and just hearing all this yelling and screaming every day and hair on fire to the point that I just couldn't take it anymore. Yeah. And then I got on the phone with Pete and it's just completely different. You know, he is just a completely measured, rational, reasonable guy who knew exactly who he was, knew exactly what he believed. And what he believed wasn't just in reaction to Donald Trump and wasn't centered around Donald Trump. And I thought that that was a voice we really needed in the Democratic Party because he was so reasonable.
So of his age, mid-30s, mm-hmm. his sexual orientation, gay, his inexperience and just the fact that he was unknown to America and the fact that his highest position was mayor of the 7th largest city in Indiana. Which one of those was the hardest one for you to overcome in terms of propelling him to a possible Democratic nomination?
They're all sort of interrelated, and they all presented challenges. And the biggest challenge, I think, they combined to make the biggest challenge of all for us, which was the number one criteria for Democratic voters was, can this candidate beat Donald Trump? They did not want to take a risk on someone. And that is ultimately why, you know, Democratic voters went with Joe Biden. So yes. The fact that Pete was 37 years old and by the end 38, the fact that he was openly gay, the fact that he was the mayor of a town that was just 100,000 people, you know, all of that did make him a little bit of a riskier candidate. A candidate that some voters thought, you know what, we like him, but maybe next time. And so I can't say that one mattered more than the other because I think all three combined to present a narrative that maybe he was a little too risky to take a chance on this time.
Yeah, I perceived and he perceived talking to him and reading his memoir. And by the way, I guess the reason I talked to him was because, you know, you okayed that media appearance. That his being gay was an asset, at least to Democrats. But what you're saying, because it would even people don't want to see themselves, especially Democrats, but I think almost every American don't want to see themselves as bigoted and racist. And the fact that they can embrace Buttigieg or even embrace Obama, it was a measurable dynamic, was an asset. But what you're saying is sort of a double bank shot. The many Democrats had a perception that others would be bigoted against him.
Yes. And that's a funny thing about Democratic primary voters and making their choice, right, is that we found that a lot of them sort of played pundit in their heads. Well, who's going to be the most electable in the general election? You know, are Republicans, are independents, are they going to be open to a gay candidate? Are they going to be open to a 37-year-old candidate? And that's how they thought of it. It wasn't necessarily that they were, you know, they themselves had an issue with his sexuality. It's that they thought other people might have an issue with his sexuality.
Now, I wanted to ask you about the Democratic Party in general, Joe Biden in specific. Let's take the second part first. Do you think he should stand for re-election?
Yes, I do. There are very few instances in history where incumbents don't run for re-election, one. But two, would he rather be at 73% than 33% in the polls right now? Yes. But there's a long time between now and 2024. And a lot of the chatter right now reminds me of the chatter around Barack Obama in 2010, which I think a lot of people forget about. But in November 2010, after Democrats got absolutely shellacked, right, during the Tea Party wave, there was all this talk and all these editorials saying, you know, it's Barack Obama should step aside. Maybe Hillary Clinton should be the candidate, but that Barack Obama had clearly failed his party and wouldn't be able to win the presidency. And, you know, boy, did he prove all of those people wrong. So I think we need to, as a party, I would like to think a lot less about 2024 and think a lot more about 2022. Because what we're seeing right now is that while Biden's numbers are low, you know, in the 30s, that the generic Democratic ballot has actually ticked up with some of the, you know, recent developments like the Dobbs decision. And, you know, I think the mass shootings have had an effect on that. And I would personally, as a Democrat, like to hear a lot more talk about what's at stake in 2022, because I think that will have a massive impact on 2024.
How bad a problem you've advocated going on, you know, Democrats should go on Fox. Pete Buttigieg goes on Fox. I heard you on The Bulwark, which is, I don't know, center right podcast saying this essentially. How bad, how big a problem for the party, for society is media siloing?
I think it's really bad for society because people now can just go and seek out media that just reinforces their worldview. Like my mom only watches MSNBC. There are people who only watch Fox. And so they really only get one perspective and think that that is, that everything else is wrong, that everyone on the other side is evil, and that there is no common ground. And that is, that's a really big problem. And I'm not sure, honestly, how we're going to fix it.
Mm-hmm. And Twitter seems to be an accelerant.
Oh, it really is. It really is because I think Twitter brings out sometimes social media. Twitter brings out the worst in people because it's a lot easier to say awful things about people if you're not face to face, and we all know this. And it allows politicians to say things that they would never say to other politicians' faces. And it's become a much bigger force in politics where staff of campaigns are on Twitter all day and they see, you know, their candidates getting, you know, raked over the coals for not being left enough on this issue, not speaking out quickly enough on this issue. And then they put pressure on, you know, people like me or the candidates and say, what are you doing? You know, we're losing Twitter today. And it's like, fuck Twitter. You know, you're not here to win Twitter. You're here to win elections. You're here to win the hearts and minds of the American people. And, you know, 80% of the American people aren't on Twitter, and 95% of the American people don't post anything on Twitter. So don't let Twitter dictate your life.
Liz Smith is the author of Any Given Tuesday, A Political Love Story. It's quite a rollicking ride. Thanks so much, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying, unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist in an assistant capacity. Joel Patterson, that guy, is the senior producer of The Gist. Michelle Pesca, COO of Peachfish Productions, among Spitzer, de Blasio, and Cuomo, will cop to voting for at least one, at least once, but no more than that.
Because as we say, it's not about me. It's about we.
The Gist is produced in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru, jeepuru, doopuru, and thanks for listening.